You're listening to Trek FM.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
The perfect liberty to kiss whomever he likes. I really couldn't care less. Was I under the impression he and I would be attending Slughorn's Christmas party together? Yes. Now, given the circumstances, I've had to make other arrangements.
Have you?
Yes. Why?
Well, I just thought, seeing as neither of us can go with who we'd really like to, we should go together as friends.
Why didn't I think of that?
Who are you going with?
It's a surprise. Anyway, it's you we've got to worry about. You can't just take anyone. See that girl over there? That's Romilda Vane. Apparently she's trying to smuggle you a love potion.
Really?
Hey, she's only interested in you because she thinks you're the chosen one.
But I am the chosen one. Okay, sorry. Kidding. I'll ask someone I like. Someone cool.
Welcome to the 602, I mean the Leaky Cauldron. It's so great to be back here. I love getting to sit back and talk a little bit of Harry Potter with some nice mead or maybe a hot butter beer or something. I always imagine butter beer being hot. We're here at episode 101 of the 602 Club. Man, we don't look a day over a century, I don't think. What do you think, Megan?
I certainly don't feel a day over a century, so it's pretty freaking cool to be on your 101st episode. It's really exciting.
Well, I mean, if you're what a century looks like, my friend, sweet damn.
Yeah, so. And likewise, right? Like, we're both looking pretty good if we're 101.
Oh, man, that'd be awesome.
Call me back for the 111th episode, and then we can celebrate our 11th birthdays together.
11th birthday, that's 111th birthday. Yes. Well, I'm really excited to be back. It's so much fun going through this series as we work towards Fantastic Beasts and where to find them, and It's just a blast to be over 100 now. Again, I just want to say a huge thank you to everybody who has been part of the show, hosting wise, and because without the hosts, this show is boring. It would be me blabbing on, and so I'm so cognizant of the fact that I have been very blessed. Want to thank so much, of course, being here on Trek FM and Chris Jones giving us this opportunity. And we love being here on Trek FM. Of course, you can find all of the shows at itunes.com/Trek FM. And while you're at iTunes, we'd love to get some more star ratings and reviews because that really helps the show grow. We've got a perfect 5-star rating right now, which I just want to say a huge thank you to everybody. It's woohoo! Well, that's right. Raise the roof
over here. You guys can't see it.
Oh, we're totally excited about that because really that's what makes this show rise in the rankings. It helps people find it. And there are a lot of general geek shows out there. So while you're over on iTunes, hit us up with a star rating and review. And of course, you'll definitely get mentioned on the show if you do give us a star rating and review. We're on Twitter at Trek FM, Facebook, facebook.com/Trek FM. And of course, we've got the listeners only discussion group, which is the Babel Conference, and you can find the Babel Conference there on Facebook. Just type Babel into the search field there, or you can go to the website at trek.fm and hit discussion on any of the menu bars. And, you know, really appreciate everybody who recently has written in for an email. Thank you so much. In fact, you know, I'm thinking, you know, maybe we should just do a mail supplemental one day. So send in your questions. I'd love to get some questions. We'll get some people together and talk about the questions. Or I could just do my own show and answer those questions for you if you just want to know more about me or things I like or whatever. Yeah, go to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club. That'll come straight to me, and I'd love to answer some questions in a supplemental for everyone. But that's not why we're here. We're here to talk about Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, which I think at this point, Megan, you know, we've been talking for a while, and And this one has a really interesting, almost cold open.
Yeah, it does.
The book has a really interesting cold open, but this one's different. And what did you, I just want to dive right in. What did you think about the way that they decide to open the film with the Death Eater attacks? And then, of course, with what they do with Harry.
Well, I do like how they kind of dive right in to this movie. We get a really brief recap of where we left off in the last film. And then, yeah, the Dementor attacks are pretty creepy. I do think the beginning is kind of awkward, though, because we've just come off of this emotional roller coaster from the last movie. And then we end up spending all of this time just kind of following Harry around London while he's macking on some chicks. And it's like, okay, I get it. He's more of an adult now. And she is pretty cute, so I totally get it. But it's not quite what I was expecting from a Harry Potter movie, I think.
Well, and it's very interesting. So if for anyone who hasn't read the books, and this is one of the things I've been trying to put myself in the mindset of somebody who hasn't read the books, the book does start with a meeting between the new Minister for Magic, Rufus Scrimgeour, as well as the Prime Minister for the Muggles, and they're having a meeting about all of these attacks that have been happening all over London and the United Kingdom. And so I thought it was interesting that the movie does that thing where instead of telling you what's been happening, they're just going to show you, which I think is great. You know, the fact that they're showing you what the Death Eaters are doing all over the UK and especially in London is really powerful. I mean, it lets us know Voldemort's here and things are going pretty badly for everyone. And it's also, I think, a good way to set up, and it should be a good way to set up, the fact that the only way to stop what's happening is for Voldemort to be destroyed, you know, for him to be stopped. So I think that's an impressive way to start the movie. But, and then we get to that point what you're talking about, Megan, which I think it is kind of weird because Harry is kind of gallivanting around London on the underground as some sort of risk-taking Lothario.
Yeah.
What? I mean, there's no way that Harry Potter is being allowed by Dumbledore or the rest of the Order of the Phoenix to do anything by himself. I mean, it just made no sense.
And it's then, so dangerous.
He has that yeah. And then he has the conversation with Dumbledore. He's like, well, I like riding around on trains. It takes my mind off things. You're like, what? Like,
weird.
I mean, he's most wanted by Voldemort,
yeah.
Right?
And he's walking around reading papers that literally have his picture in them. Like, that's not totally bizarre and wouldn't completely give him away. Even the girl in the shop, she's like, I swear I saw those pictures move. Even a muggle could potentially pick up on something weird going on the way that he's behaving at the beginning of the movie.
Well, and when she says, you know, who's this Harry Potter? And he's like, a bit of a tosser, really.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, yeah,
you are
a bit of a tosser. And that's what's so strange about the opening of the film. You know, I think it starts out really strong with the Death Eater attacks. But then when we get to Harry, it's so strange because it's so disjointed.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the movie is trying to tell us in every way possible that Harry is in love with Ginny. Like, we finally got to that point in the storyline where, you know, Harry and Ginny are getting closer and they're finally going to be together in this movie. But the beginning of the movie does everything it can to tell you that Harry apparently is just some sort of, like,
teenager?
D-bag. Yeah, like,
he's a teenage boy.
He's the worst of a teenage boy, you know, pretending to have a real heart for somebody, but being ready to, you know, get it on with whoever. I just don't understand.
He's a teenage boy. Like, I can forgive it. But it is, it's a little awkward, especially because of how heavily they put the Ginny storyline into the forefront. And just they really, really push that, which I feel like they kind of have to do because I didn't feel like it was pushed as hard in the book when I was reading the books. For me, that relationship kind of came out of left field in the books. So I think they were trying to avoid that in the films.
Yeah, that's interesting because for me, I always kind of felt that relationship there. And it was one of those things that was just in the background and it would happen when it was going to happen. It was just something that was going to take time. And I actually really love the fact that, you know, Jenny is a character, and I guess it's a great time to talk about it. She's a character who is in love with Harry, but her life is not going to be defined by Harry.
That is one of the things I really like about her.
Right. If she's not going to see him, she's going to live her life. You know, she's going to go be with other people and try out other relationships, see if they work, you know. And I think that's one of the things that was really wonderful about Ginny and Hermione is that both of them, you know, it's clear throughout the series, I think, that they have certain people that they do like, but they don't wait for them to just be there for them. You know, they both, you know, Hermione with Crumb and Ginny with a few other people that she dates throughout the series. But it's because she's not going to be defined by that. And I think that's a really cool thing. The fact that, you know, this show, it's very subtle.
Yeah.
But it's giving you a great look at a character that, you know, she is who she is.
They behave like normal people, right? They don't get obsessive about these relationships that are clearly not going to work out. They decide to move on with their lives, right? So it's really great to see female characters behaving that way because so often they tend to be pushed into these obsessive relationships, right? So it's nice to see them behaving like normal people.
Well, and back a little bit, you know, so the opening of the film, not a huge fan of the fact of what they're doing with Harry, but the other thing that I was really disappointed in is that, you know, in the book, it starts off very intentionally that Harry has gotten a letter from Dumbledore, and he says to Harry, I'm going to take a much more, you know, active approach, basically, in your learning this year, and we are going to be diving in and discovering all we can about Voldemort together so that we can find a way to defeat him. That is never talked about in this film. Yeah. Like, there is nowhere where, I mean, and it could have been an easy conversation because Dumbledore and Harry have their scenes together when they go to recruit Slughorn, but it's never stated there. So again, if you haven't read the book, this movie makes no sense. You're like, what's going on? Like, it doesn't really do a great job of coming together. And I think that's really frustrating.
Yeah, I think they had a lot that they were trying to fit in here. And I think there are certain aspects like what you're talking about that suffer because of it. All that being said, though, I did still really enjoy this movie. It's been a really long time since I watched it. And since our last discussion, I was like, I just got to watch the next one. So I dove right in and was ready to go within a couple days of us recording our last episode. But yeah, I do think there are aspects of the story that suffer. And since it's been so long since I've seen the movie and read the books, there were some things that I was confused about and that I just didn't fully remember from my history with the Harry Potter universe. So I felt like, man, I should have reread the book before I watched this movie.
Well, and it is one of those where there are quite a bit of changes to the film. The fact that, one, there are a bunch of different pensive trips that aren't there. Mm. And really what's frustrating about it is in that way, you're not helping the audience who's just only seen the movies understand Voldemort, but you're also not helping set up what's supposed to come in the next film. So if you walk out of this movie and you've only seen the movies and you never read the books, you barely have an idea of what a Horcrux is and what they're searching for. You know, Rowling does a great job in the book of showing you different Horcruxes that they're going to be looking for. And then I think there's about like three or four, and I think there's three that they still aren't quite sure of, but they have an idea of what they are. This, you have like an idea of what one of them is, and the rest is a complete mystery. So it's like those kind of changes, I think, really actually hurt not only this story, but the next story. And it's frustrating because this whole thing is supposed to be about, and this whole story is about the setup. I mean, it really is. It is the setup for the end. Yeah. And if you only watch the movies, this is a really bad setup for the end because you don't really understand what's being set up.
Yeah, absolutely. I was definitely confused about a couple of things for sure.
Well, and kind of going on some of those changes, I was really frustrated that in the middle of the movie, instead of Scrimgeour visiting the Burrow and kind of continuing the theme that was so prevalent in the fifth movie, which is politics, and the way that politics tries to cover up a multitude of sins and bad things that are happening. And that's a huge part of this book, because Harry is being recruited actively by the ministry to try and come on as the public face of saying the ministry is doing everything it should and Harry Potter's behind us, you know? And none of that's in the movie, and it's very frustrating because that's such a great theme that connects so well with the last book and the last film. Even the film does a great job of showing that political side. And instead of having that really big scene at the Burrow at Christmas at the Weasley's house, we have a weird action scene that's not in the movie and is just really dumb.
It is dumb. It's a really awkward scene, and a lot of characters' actions don't make a lot of sense to me in that scene. And when it happened, I was like, I don't remember this at all. Why don't I remember this at all? It's because it's not in the book. So, yeah, I mean, them running off into the cornfield all by themselves and Jenny running after Harry, it was just awkward.
Yeah, it doesn't fit. Yeah. At all. And I think maybe that they just felt like they needed an action scene or something. But I feel like at that point of the story, it would have been much better if you had just been kind of weaving in one of the themes that you had had in the fifth movie and continuing that theme here, because it also is a theme that continues on into the seventh book as well, of the way in which government, because the government's about to be overtaken. And so I think there's just such a layer and a depth that you just miss when you just add in a dumb action scene that has no effect on any of the characters, because we know none of them are going to die. You know, it doesn't help.
Why destroy the Burrow, right?
Yeah.
Why do that?
Because they're just going to be there again in the next movie.
Yeah.
You know, and you already know that by the time you're making this movie, you know what comes next. So it doesn't make any sense. It's just it's a wasted like 7 minutes of screen time.
Yeah. And 7 minutes is a long time.
Yeah. In a movie that's 2 hours and like 30 some odd minutes, why don't you just give us another pensive scene then? So at least we understand. I mean, you could do two pensive scenes in 7 minutes to help explain Voldemort better. This just doesn't do anything. So I don't understand.
It helps us know that Harry and Ginny are even closer together than we thought.
Oh, because they've been brought together by battle. Yeah,
she runs after him.
Yeah, that doesn't. Them almost kissing on the scene would have. I mean, it would have been so much better, you know, they're on the stair there and they almost kiss, and it would have been so much better if there had just been like a door knock and it had been Scrimgeour coming and saying, you know, I need to talk to Harry. Anyway,
we gotta give Bellatrix so more screen time.
I mean, she's fantastic, you know, but that's just not necessary in this film. well, it's funny because, too, I was really shocked that at the end of the film, there isn't any of the Battle of Hogwarts. because that's a part of the book where it kind of does the Lord of the Rings kind of thing, or the Chronicles of Narnia, where it happens and then you're told the story later because Harry's busy in the story at that point. It's really from his point of view. But it's a big thing that's happening all over the school, and like there's none of that. And it was really interesting to me that the end of the film is so low key. Like the stakes seem so low almost. And whereas I felt like in the book, this was the most emotional that I was anytime that I was reading Harry Potter, because from all the time that Harry had been spending with Dumbledore and everything that's going on, it just feels like, oh, what are they going to do without him? You know, but I'm not left with that in the movie. I don't know. What did it work for you? The change that they make there and the way that they handle that, especially Dumbledore's death?
Well, I think that his death definitely feels more hollow in the movie. And I don't know if that is the fault of this movie or of all of the movies put together, right? Because I feel like Dumbledore is not as close to us as movie viewers as he becomes to us as book readers. Because I remember when I read this book, part of the reason I've only read this book once is because of Dumbledore. Because it's so emotional for me. I was crying for like 5 chapters. Because I knew it was coming. I could sense it coming, and it was devastating to me. And then after it happened, the book continues for a little while, and it was devastating. Watching the movie, it doesn't feel that way at all. And you know it's coming. You sense it coming in the same way, but it just did not have the emotional resonance. I do think that is the fault of the series as a whole, as opposed to just this one movie. Because he's just not that same. He's not the spirit of the movies in the same way as he is the spirit of the books.
I think you make a really good point, and I love what you're saying. Because, and I think you could have, you know, if I'm being critical, if I put my critical pants on, which I wore today, luckily, if I put those on, I'm thinking if the movie had started off with Dumbledore's letter, or just Dumbledore meeting Harry, say, you know, somewhere together, and them having the conversation about Dumbledore saying, I need to take an active role in teaching you this year, and I want you to go on this journey with me, and making it about that relationship, like that the movie, you know, the movies always just follow Harry's story. And I feel like they don't do a good job really of following Harry's story as much in this movie, yeah, because they're not connecting him with Dumbledore as much as you need to be. You need to have that connection, because like you said, there's a hollowness to the death of Dumbledore because we haven't spent that quality time of those two together. I mean, a good chunk of the book of the Half-Blood Prince is Harry and Dumbledore together exploring the utter scary depths of the evilest wizard that's ever been alive and trying to figure out a way to bring him down together. And that partnership there, you don't feel that when he's dead, what's Harry going to do in the movie, yeah. I don't think. And that is frustrating. And I think you're right. It's definitely a fault of the entire series, but it's definitely, I think, a big fault of just the screenwriting for this film.
Yeah, I could agree with you there. And like you said, because we're not necessarily just following Harry's story in this movie, we're also following Snape's story, and we're also following Malfoy's story to an extent. And so we're starting, our emotions are split between a lot of different characters in this film, and I don't think that it ever gets us fully focused on those emotions across all three of them.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. There does seem to be a little bit too much focus on Malfoy.
Mm. Well, there has to be, though. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but I don't know. And maybe it's just the way that it's shot and done and everything. I don't know.
They could have used their time more efficiently. I feel like this film is not as efficiently and tightly directed as it could have been.
And I think that part, again, I think it just comes to the script. Yeah. Like, I feel like the script is so tight and so lean for the fifth movie, which it's not Steve Kloves who writes that. And they find a way to distill the most important aspects, I think, of that book. And that's the longest book. Yeah. And yet, this one's not the longest, and they're not able to, I think, find the narrative flow that's tight and lean and focused and feels like it's really doing all that it needs to do. Because, again, this book has so much important information in it that's just being left out, and you're hurting your audience. So I think it's a frustration, because also I think one of the changes that really hurts the whole Dumbledore story is the fact that there's no funeral at the end.
That's part of the things that makes you bawl the most when you're reading the book, is having to go through that. You've already gone through the horrible events, and then you have to go through the funeral, which is, you go through the whole emotional arc of losing someone you love when you read the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then the after effects of the funeral of, you know, Fox leaves forever, Ginny and Harry actually breaking up.
Yeah.
Because he has to go do what he's got to do, this mission that Dumbledore sent him on. And again, it's a decent scene at the end of the movie, but it doesn't work great because it's just not as impactful, because you don't truly, if you're just watching the movie, you don't necessarily get exactly what Harry's going to do. And you also don't have any idea what he's searching for, other than the fact that you know that it could be anything.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, well, that's a literal needle in a haystack.
Yeah, actually, it didn't even really stand out to me watching it this time that they were deciding not to come back to Hogwarts. I don't think that was made overtly clear to me.
Yeah, no, it's there because Harry, you know, is talking about how he's not going to come back, and Hermione's saying, you know, well, you're sometimes really dense. We're going to go with you.
I don't, but yeah, it didn't click to me. I mean, I just watched this movie, and that didn't click to me until you said it just now.
Well, and there's another a big change that happens, because this whole movie is called The Half-Blood Prince.
Yeah.
And in the book, and of course in the film, it's revealed that the Half-Blood Prince is Snape. Because we don't get the funeral and we don't get Hermione finally figuring out who and how Snape is the Half-Blood Prince, we don't get any of that information. The reveal of the fact that he is the Half-Blood Prince, it almost, people might hate me for saying this, but it feels like finding out Khan is Khan in Star Trek Into Darkness. It only matters if you've seen The Wrath of Khan. Otherwise, if you don't, you're like, okay, so it's Khan, that's great.
What does that mean?
It's the same way as like, oh, he's the Half-Blood Prince. I mean, what does that mean? If you haven't read the book, you don't really know, because you don't get any information on what that means to Snape. And what's interesting is the information that it kind of gives you about that character as well, especially as we're moving in to the last story.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, because again, being so far removed from the last time I read the books, I remembered who it was, but I didn't remember the significance of why he called himself that. But I did really love that part of the story. Watching it this time was Harry playing around with the book and knowing who it was, and watching him excel in potions because of it and really drive Hermione crazy. And I love the moment when he uses that Sectum Sempra curse, and how devastatingly horrific that curse is, and he used it without having any idea what it would do, which is one of the stupidest things that he could have possibly done, especially after being warned by Hermione all semester, like, you don't know who wrote this stuff, you can't just take it with a grain of salt, right? You have to be careful. And I do love how that's how it kind of reveals itself to Snape. But I don't think it did that storyline as much justice as it could have.
Well, because it's interesting, in the book, it's revealed that Snape's mother was, her last name was Prince, and Snape hates his Muggle father. Therefore, he calls himself the Half-Blood Prince in honor of his mother and who she is and what she represents. And it's a badge of honor for him, obviously, when he's, you know, so connected with Voldemort in his early years, that he's the half-blood prince. He's claiming only the blood that he would consider to be any good at that point. And that's a really important aspect.
It's not there at all.
Yeah, you get none of that, because, again, that's something that gets revealed at the funeral as Harry and Hermione and Ron talk with each other. And she's finally unraveled the mystery of who this half-blood prince is, because the whole book, too, and she's in the library, she can't figure out who it is. And I thought that was really interesting aspect of the story. And again, it gives you more depth to, you know, why it's called this, what the impact you're supposed to get from it, you know, and it's just not there. So I don't know. A lot of the changes, I feel like, from book to movie here really are detriment to this story. I feel like in any Harry Potter book, just like in Lord of the Rings, always go back to Rowling, you know, always go back to Tolkien. They knew what they were doing. And so if you go back to the source material, you're really going to be better off than if you stray too far. And I feel like this is the movie that strays so far from its source material, it has a hard time writing that ship. And that's kind of a frustration for me.
Well, I'll tell you what's not frustrating, though, is getting more Alan Rickman. I was so excited to get more
that is true.
This movie. And he's just phenomenal.
Oh, he's excellent. Yeah, he is.
I miss him so much.
I love when he's talking to Harry at the party, you know, and he's telling him that Dumbledore won't be around. And Harry asks him a question after he's finished talking, and he just looks at him a little bit, just like quickly, and turns and walks away.
I mean, there's just...
It's like the best.
There's so much brilliant acting going on, and there's always a lot of subtlety happening with him and Dan Radcliffe when they're on camera together. You can... I think I've said this before on a previous episode, is you can really, if you're looking at them as actors, you can really see that mentor-mentee relationship coming through on screen. And it's so beautifully done. Even if there's stuff happening that we don't necessarily agree with, you can really appreciate this beautiful acting that's happening on screen.
Exactly. No, I completely agree with you. And I feel like Alan Rickman is just as divine as ever as he is as an actor in this film.
Is.
And yeah, he does himself proud. One, you know, we have one really big new character in the film, I guess, to talk about, and that is Slughorn. And I just wondered what you thought about him and his portrayal, Jim Brumbent coming in and playing the role. Did he kind of fit what you thought of in the book, and did he bring that to life in a way that you were happy with?
You know, I love Brumbent. So I was just really excited to see him. I think he works well in the role. I liked his addition to the cast, and I like how he's kind of slimy in a way, but
yes,
you kind of forgive him for it, because you genuinely kind of want to hang out with this guy, because even though he's one of those annoying name droppers who doesn't necessarily do a lot of things himself, he kind of latches onto other people's coattails. He does have all of these really incredible connections and really incredible stories. And I thought he did a great job of portraying that aspect of the character.
What's interesting about him, I think you really nailed it. He doesn't seem to have an innate amount of talent himself. His talent seems to be to recognize talent in others and to foster it. And so he has the ability, it seems like he is a very good teacher in his class. He's obviously good at teaching his students and kind of being able to find those people that have the rare abilities, and he has a way of being able to foster that and really, I think, bring out some of the best in them. by making them feel special and cared about and all of that. And so, yeah, it is a really interesting thing. There is a huge amount of selfishness that goes into it, but there's something else that's actually beneficial for those who are benefiting from that. And I think that's a really interesting thing to watch. And I think Broadbent just plays it well. The only thing I would have loved is if he was a little bit larger.
I could see that.
Because and he doesn't have a mustache, because I remember in the book he has a big, you know, burly mustache, which would have been fun. But no, I think he brings a lot of fun to the role. And in that first scene, you have him with Dumbledore and Harry, and they fix the room and all. It's perfect. I think it's really well done.
You know, the only thing that would have made it better is if they had styled him a little bit more closely to his character from Moulin Rouge. Oh. It would have been like that much better. Because as bad as that movie is, it's a guilty pleasure of mine. And Jim Broadbent is so great in that film. And it's kind of a similar character, right? Like, he's taking these people who have talent and bringing them to him, but he's also very questionable in his line of work. Like, he runs a whorehouse, right? So I like these characters that he plays, like Slughorn, where they're so complicated. What a complicated character that is, right? Like you said, he can identify these great aspects in people, but then he also just completely tosses people away if he doesn't think they're of value. Someone like Neville, who is actually of great value. He is just shy and quiet and not flashy about his talents. So, you know, he's drawn in by flash and stardom, which is not necessarily a great trait to have. So I love how complicated he is as a character. And yeah, I really don't know who I would have cast instead of Jim Broadbent, to be totally honest.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone. You know, I have to say, Moulin Rouge, that's where I fell even more in love with Ewan McGregor when I learned he could sing.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And the fact that all you need is love.
I'm gonna have to watch that. I've been thinking about it recently.
I just need to listen to that song because it's running in my head now. But it's he really is great in the role, and I'm so glad that they pulled him in, another fantastic British actor, into the Harry Potter universe. And that's one of the things about this movie, bouncing off of Broadbent and Slughorn. I think it's interesting because this movie is the funniest of all of them.
I think so.
You know, even the fourth movie, this one is the one there's the most comedy, and I think it's because that love is in the air, and everybody's a little bit, you know, in the mood.
The hormones are definitely flowing in this movie.
The hormones are flowing like butterbeer.
Like spice.
And so, exactly. And it's great. I mean, and the kids are really responding to it in the way that they're bringing that all to life. And I loved it. I think that, to me, is the thing that works the best in this film.
Yeah, they nailed the teenage angst. They did a great job of that in the last one too. Like, just like we said, they've really been nailing that, this stage of teenagehood, right? That awkward relationship building time in a teenager's life.
Well, and the way in which, you know, the different characters are kind of clueless about things, especially Ron, is very funny. And I have to say that tipsy Hermione is the best.
Isn't
Hermione
she cute?
She is. Yeah, she's so funny as she's like hugging her boys, you know. It's adorable. And it's not in the book, but the scene that they have with Harry and Hermione on the steps.
Isn't that a beautiful little scene?
It's the best scene in the film. And it's because those two actors make you believe that they are best friends.
Yeah.
And they're both heartbroken because the people that they do love don't seem to see it. I have to say, Emma Watson and Daniel Radcliffe give a masterful performance in that scene, because it just feels, I mean, I don't know about you, but I had plenty of those kind of conversations in high school and in college and whatnot, and feeling like that and sitting down with a good friend and just, it was awful. And I can feel that in that scene. And I absolutely 100% adore it.
And there's something really special too about the fact that they're both going through the exact same thing at the exact same time. And so they're able to sympathize with one another in an even extra special way, right? Because when you're going through something, it feels so much different than it does after you've made it through it. So it's easy to give advice after you've made it through something difficult like that. But when you're both in it together, friends can take such really special strength from one another when you're having to fight the same battles together.
Well, and this is interesting too, because, you know, think back on the books. A lot of the books, Harry is between Ron and Hermione who are fighting.
Right, yeah.
Or they're both fighting with Hermione. And so there's this back and forth in the books. And then part of that is just, that's what, you know, kids of that age do. It's just the way it is. But this was the only movie where a majority of it, Ron, Harry, and Hermione aren't all together all the time. Because Harry's bouncing back and forth between his friends because they're fighting. And it was really interesting. And it worked really well. I thought they played it. Just everything about the way they made that work was wonderful. And I don't know. That's, to me, again, the interpersonal relationships between the kids, all of that stuff was working like gangbusters in this film. It's really the best part of the
movie. Yeah, I completely agree with you there.
And that leads me to one of the most interesting things about the story is that Harry himself, he's really smart. Like, he figures out what's going on in a lot of this story, and nobody believes him. He knows exactly what Draco's doing, and nobody will believe him because everybody just thinks he's like, oh, you just don't like Draco.
Well, can you blame them, though? I mean, he spent 6 years just hating. The two of them have spent 6 years just going after one another, just poking and prodding at each other. So it's easy to dismiss that, right? Especially when it's two teenagers. And nobody would, first of all, people don't even believe that Voldemort is really back, or they're just starting to realize it, right? So it makes sense to me that people would not jump to the conclusion that he's using a child as a weapon.
Well, and that, I mean, gets into something that's really interesting. One is that it goes to show that what Harry does want to be, which is an Auror, he's already good at.
It does.
Because he's already been able to pick up on the things that other people can't when it comes to people involved in dark wizardry. I think that's fantastic. But also, I think it goes to this interesting idea, like you said, Voldemort using a child as a weapon, and just how evil he is. It leads to something that's, I think, truly fascinating in the story of watching this trial of Draco Malfoy. I think that's something that was really fascinating to see Voldemort use Malfoy, because nobody would believe that somebody would use a kid like that. But that happens in our world every day.
Yeah, and it's deplorable that people do that.
It was interesting, too, because throughout the story, you know, Malfoy has always been kind of a little, yeah, you know what I'm thinking.
A little S-H-I-T.
He's been one of those. Yeah, one of those, or one of those D words. Pick whatever ones you want. But dog, you know, that, yeah, you know, you're on the right track. What's interesting here is to watch his mother and him be put in this awful situation. And we don't see Lucius in this film, but we will in the next one. And the Malfoys are really beginning to realize in a lot of ways that everything they said they always wanted may not be what they always thought they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. I particularly love that scene at the beginning when you see Snape take the Unbreakable Curse with Narcissa. And I think that Helen McRory's performance as Narcissa Malfoy is particularly moving, even though she's not even in the film for that long. but you really feel for her as a mother, as someone who was moving down this path that she thought was, I don't know, whatever motivated her to go down that path. And it's really led her to regret some of the decisions that she's made in her life. So I love watching her struggle with the consequences of her actions. And I love seeing Tom Felton's performance going through basically the same thing, dealing with the consequences of his parents' actions and the way that he was raised. It's heartbreaking.
Well, it makes for an interesting contrast because, you know, there are people who like feeling superior to each other, and their belief system has allowed them to pretend that they are superior to everyone. But the moment that is challenged by something that's truly superior to them is scary. You know, they are at the realization of finally of, oh, well, we're really not any better, and we're not really cared about by our belief system and what we've said we've always believed. We've kind of maybe put our faith in the wrong thing. Yeah. And we've lived, you know, with the wrong set of values, and it's all coming back to bite us in the butt now. And I think it's really interesting to watch that play out in this family, and it continues obviously on into the next book and into the next film, and I think it's really interesting.
Well, and you sympathize with them as human beings too, right? You don't necessarily think, well,
for the first time ever.
For the first time ever. You're not sitting there thinking like, well, they deserved it. You actually feel for them as human characters and, you know, just feel terrible that this is the situation that they found themselves in because of how they've chosen to live their lives. And I love, again, Alan Rickman's performance too, because you can tell he genuinely takes that oath because he really does want to protect Malfoy, because he fully understands what they've gotten themselves into. So again, there's some really excellent acting happening there where you can tell he doesn't want to do it, but he genuinely does. He's a really conflicted character, and I loved getting to see that on screen.
No, I completely agree with you, and I think it makes for a really interesting thing because Dumbledore, because Snape there isn't just promising that he's going to protect Malfoy, but I think he's also continuing on with the promise that he's made in the pact that he has with Dumbledore.
Absolutely.
And so there's so many more layers here. And again, that's a frustrating thing because the movie can't and doesn't do a good enough job of really helping you know what's truly behind everything. Yeah. And that's just a frustration. So one of the things that I really noticed about this film, and this is, again, and this is funny because it's jumping back to what we were talking about with Harry, but I really like the way that Harry takes care of his friends.
He's such a good friend, isn't he?
Yeah. You know, we kind of always think of the person in the like Harry as being all out for themselves. But I mean, just this, the way in which, you know, he's got the Felix Felicis, and he realizes that Ron is just going to be awful at his first Quidditch game. And he knows exactly what his friend needs. His friend needs to be able to get out of his mind and just be able to perform, because his friend's good enough to do that. And the best way to do that is to trick him into thinking that he's got a magic potion that's going to make him the, you know, the placebo, basically. And I love that about Harry, that he does that for his friend, and not because it's just going to help him and his team win, but because he doesn't want Ron going out there and looking like an idiot in front of everyone.
Well, and he wants Ron to believe in himself, and really, like, that's why the placebo works so well, because it doesn't just give him strength for one day. It teaches him strength for his whole life. It's a lesson that he can carry with him forever. And we should all be so lucky to have a friend like Harry Potter, really. Like, what a good friend he is.
Yeah. Well, and then, I mean, we talked about his relationship with Hermione and how he's there for her. Yeah. And then I just love classic Harry. He takes Luna to the party with him.
Isn't that,
you know,
the,
like,
best? I love that so much.
It's just the best ever. And she's talking about how she wears shoes to bed because she ends up wandering the halls, sleepwalking at night. And it's just, man, what great stuff. She's so perfect
she really
in that
is.
Role. Well, I'm trying to think if there's anything that we really missed about the movie. And I think the only thing I want to ask you about that I'm thinking of right now was the Felix Felicis scene with Harry on Felix Felicis.
Yeah.
And how do you, because my wife turned to me, she's like, is he playing it like he's drunk?
He's playing it like he was high.
Yeah.
Like, that was the impression that I got. And I was like, oh, that was not the direction I would have gone. It was a little awkward.
No, because the way he's like, then come on, and it's just so weird. It's like, what's wrong with you? I mean, the funniest part is when he's like, and the pinches. And it was
overboard. It was a little too much. It was overblown.
Well, and what's strange about it too is it Felix Felicis and what it's supposed to give you, it seems like it would make you the best version of yourself.
Yeah, and it made him just a silly, stupid version.
Right. It doesn't seem like it would make you the high version of yourself. I mean, apparently Pineapple Express and Felix Felicis have a lot in common. So just didn't know.
No, there's a comparison just the Wizarding I never World. Thought I'd hear.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, you didn't know that those two things were so much, so similar. So.
Wow.
Yeah. And I do have to say this. So I was reading up a little bit on this film, and one of the things that I noticed is that this is the first Harry Potter movie where they do a lot of color correction, where there's a heavy tone correction in the film, and it definitely sets a mood from the very beginning. But I was noticing how well that made all the visual effects and the background work that they do. What I mean is the CG backdrops that they're doing, because they're compositing all that together with the color correction and the color grading, I feel like it looked really good, because when they're playing Quidditch, it looked fantastic. Things like that just looked better than they have in other Harry Potter movies. And this is the one Harry Potter movie where I feel like that the CGI work, for the most part, holds up better than anything else we've seen so far.
I will say that. I do think the CGI work looked a lot better in this one than it had. I don't think we saw as many fantastical characters in this one. So I feel like that's always the downfall, right, is the fully CG characters. But I really am so tired of this cyan orange phase that we're in film creation right now. And I didn't like it in this movie either.
No, I can understand what you're saying.
Everything is shifted
you're saying.
So cyan in this movie.
Yeah, there is definitely a huge amount of color grading that happens in the movie. And you're absolutely right. And I think here it's meant to have that foreboding tone. Because in the book, Rowling describes how, you know, now that the mentors are loose, they're causing it to rain all the time. People are, you know, generally depressed because their dementors are loose everywhere. So it really does, I think, in this film fit, but I understand what you're saying, because a lot of movies have been doing this kind of thing. So it just feels like, oh, well, they're doing the same thing they've done before.
Yeah. I think for me, it's been going on too long. So it's hard for me to appreciate sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the reasons that they do it in general, just color grading for film, is because when you do that, it helps everything blend together, especially when you have a lot of CGI work.
Yeah.
Everything. But I think you're right. You need to make sure that tone fits the movie that you're doing and not just look like every other movie.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, and I totally get, like you're saying, it helps you match everything a lot more easily. I don't know. For whatever reason, it stood out to me even more when I was watching this film than it had in previous ones. And I guess I was just sick of it the day that I watched this movie.
Well, no, and I think, you know, the fact that we've been watching all these movies, you know, throughout the year, and we just did the last one, but this one definitely has a distinct look to it as compared to the others.
Yeah, it does.
And I think that you see it here even more than you did in the fifth one, because there's color grading in that, but it's not as severe as it is in here. So I completely understand what you're saying. Which leads me to, in the end, what would you rate The Half-Blood Prince?
I'd give it a 3.5 out of 5. I'll say 3.5 Half-Blood Prince potions books out of 5. Because there is still some really great stuff happening here. In particular, some of the phenomenal acting that we've been gushing over today. But there are some definite problems with this movie, and it's not my favorite Harry Potter film.
Wow, I think you just completely nailed it. Not much of that I can add to that because my rating is exactly the same. It's probably 3.25, 3.5,
Ooh,
depending on the
we're
day.
We're really splitting hairs now. I love it.
Yeah. Definitely. It's like we're splitting Aragog hairs. So yeah, 3.25 Aragog hairs since he died in this film. And I'm right there with you. To me, this is honestly the worst of the Harry Potter movies. And people might be shocked to think that I think that. But I just don't think this movie is very good. And the reason that I think that is for the reasons that we mentioned. And again, I've had to put myself in the mindset, what if I'm only watching the films? What if I've never read the books? What does this movie leave me with? And what I realize what this movie leaves me with is not very much. And yeah, that's not a good thing when I'm going into the end of the series. That's a really bad movie-making choice because you can never assume that your audience has read or watched or done something else. You always need to assume that they need to be told the most amount of information in the least amount of time.
Yeah.
And so to me, it really is lackluster in that area. And I'd say the one that's next to that is probably The Goblet of Fire because of the way in which it doesn't give you enough information. So, yeah, I don't hate the movie,
yeah,
obviously.
Me either.
And there's a ton that I love about it. The fact that I absolutely love the interpersonal relationship stuff. That's what I love watching about this film. And that's why I will keep watching this movie. The rest of it just falls flat for me for the most part.
Yeah. You know what you said earlier? You reminded me of Aragog's death, right? In this movie, mm-hmm, we see a funeral for a spider, but not for Dumbledore.
Oh, gosh. That's awful. That's a 3-star movie.
Yeah.
You're right. Forget 3.25.
That knocks
it's
it down
a
to a
3-star.
I think I completely agree.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely
right.
That's
a big problem.
It totally is a big problem. You know what's not a big problem, though? Is that we have amazing associate producers here on the 602 Club who make sure that we can keep doing this show, which I love. So excited to have men of this caliber and people of this caliber supporting the network through Patreon. I really appreciate that Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, and Norman Lau are associate producers here on the show through Patreon. Thank you so much to all of you who have gone to Patreon already and seen how you can support the network. This network is massive. And it does cost a lot to keep it running, and we can't do it without listeners just like you. So just go to patreon.com/trekfm, and you can see how you can be part of the team and help support the network each and every week. Every little bit helps. So again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Megan, I gotta say, I think we had a fantastic show today. I just really do. I had so much fun talking about this film with you. And, you know, for all that we talked about that I don't love, I really brought home to me that some of the things that I truly do love about the movie. And so I hope everybody will go check it out. And what I hope this series is doing, if you've never read the books, please go
read
the books. Go read the books. Just go read the books. But as they're reading the books, Megan, and where can they find you and tweet you out their questions? And, of course, the podcast that you're on and, then of course, the podcast network that you're a part of as well.
Yeah, so if you want to find me personally, I'm at Meg Calcote, MEGCALCOTE. And you can find me at that handle on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to know more about my podcast, it's called Educating Geeks. And it's very similar to what Matthew does here on the 602 Club. We like to find people who have never experienced our favorite fandoms and bring them into the fold. We don't revoke geek cards. If we find out a friend of ours has never read or seen Harry Potter movies, we sit down, watch them, and talk about it after and see what they think from a newbie perspective.
Yes, you don't revoke geek cards. You actually just give out.
That's right. We're issuing geek cards left and right because that's what the community is about. We want to welcome new people. So you can find us at educatinggeeks.com or we're Educating Geeks on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Easy to find us.
That's right. And what are you doing? If you're not listening to them, you should be because it's a lot of fun. I've been over there on the show before and you shouldn't just check it out because of that. You should check it out because it's awesome. While you're doing that, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones. You can also find me on Literary Treks with Bruce and Dan where we're talking about the books and comics of Star Trek. We're also getting an opportunity to interview the authors, talk about their latest works, which is a lot of fun, so please check that out. Of course, we have the 602 Club Star Wars feed, so all the Star Wars episodes are in their own special feed. Just search for Star Wars, a 602 Club collection, so just check that out on iTunes. It's a lot of fun, and we can definitely use your star reading reviews there. And, of course, I'm on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, where we talk all about Star Wars each week. It's so much fun. We have a blast just diving into some strange, esoteric topic each week. Make sure you check that out on thenerdparty.com, or, of course, you can also check that out on iTunes. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear?